The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. I hope you all enjoyed a nice lunch and some conversation with colleagues. I'm Jamie Abrams, an instructor here at the Washington College of Law in the Legal Rhetoric Program, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity today to introduce and moderate our distinguished panel on metaphors and legal rhetoric to kick off our afternoon. I want to begin with a brief introduction of our speakers. Christy DeSanctis is an associate professor of legal research and writing and the director of the legal research and writing program at our neighboring institution, the George Washington University. She's been teaching there since 2002. She's also taught undergraduate courses in English and a course on persuasive writing based on Aristotle's rhetoric. She has an MA in English language and literature. Her master's thesis focused on a detailed examination of the application of cognitive language theory, including metaphor theory, to law. She's also currently a PhD student in English language and literature at the University of Maryland. She recently published a textbook, Legal Research and Writing, with Foundation Press. J. Gordon Christie is currently a professor at the Mississippi College School of Law. He's been teaching there since 2002 and had a lengthy career in private practice before entering teaching, where he served as special counsel to the deputy counsel for the Ford Motor Company and partner at Johnson & Gibbs and Strasburger & Price. His areas of expertise include legal analysis and reasoning, as well as contracts, antitrust, business associations, commercial paper, and debtor-creditor rights. He's also the author of Understanding and Learning the Law. And finally, Linda Berger is currently a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Her research and writing work focuses on legal composition, legal rhetoric, metaphor theory, and emerging First Amendment and media law. She's published widely on the subject of legal rhetoric and the law, including most recently an upcoming publication in the Mercer Law Review on rhetorical choices in Supreme Court decisions on campaign finance regulation. She's been teaching lawyering skills since 1989 and is a founding member and current editor of the Journal of the Association of Legal Writing Directors. So thank you to each of you for joining us here today. To begin our discussion, Christy is going to lead us off by laying a foundation with some introductory remarks about metaphor and metaphorical thinking as a literary device. Following Christy's remarks, Gordon Christie will follow with a discussion of aspects of metaphor from the linguistic perspective. And finally, Linda Berger will close with some models of metaphor in application in family courts. And then we look forward to hearing your comments and opening it up for dialogue following the speaker's remarks.
Okay. So I'm actually going to do a little bit of both thinking about metaphor as a literary device, but what I'm more interested in is came out of one of the questions this morning about whether and to what extent there's a difference between language and the mind, language and thought. So it's true, I'm going to provide some context, hopefully, for what I think my colleagues will talk about more in terms of application to the law. But before we get there, I thought it would be helpful to identify what we mean by metaphor, what metaphor is, what metaphorical thinking means. And though this might seem like too basic a point of departure, I actually think it's an essential foundation for, because I think that there's more than one notion about what constitutes metaphor. So first, for I think many people, myself included, and certainly the way that metaphor was written about prior to about 1980, it was a rhetorical flourish. So the possibly most common definition of metaphor comes from its use as a literary device or a trope, common primarily in poetic writing in which two things are compared directly to each other. So Shakespeare's, if you look in my Figures of Speech book that I have, one of the first examples for metaphor, Shakespeare's All the World's a Stage. And I'll return to this example in a second. But immediately, a few things are worth noting about this. First, this understanding of metaphor is largely a function of language only, the form of language, I mean by that, which is one reason why I think it's taught frequently in connection with poetry, where with fewer words than prose, an author can call up a series of associations and emotions without directly stating them, simply by invoking the comparison. So to state simply that the world is a stage certainly employs an economy of words. I don't I don't doubt that. Unachievable by listing all of the ways in which the world is like a stage. But what's really going on here, I would say, is much more than just a matter of saving space, and therefore much more than just a matter of the actual words selected. And Shakespeare himself devotes another 26 lines after the invocation of this metaphor to elaborating on it, in which he presents instances of the metaphor in operation. And so part of the attraction of metaphor as a literary device is to challenge the ways that we think. Thus, the second point that I want to make here at the outset is that the comparison is often between subjects in two different contexts, the result being that the second term provides a new way of conceiving or conceptualizing the first term. So in the example that I just gave, the notion is not just that the world shares certain characteristics with a literal stage, but that it is a stage of sorts in which people, where people play out certain roles like actors would in a play. Still, the traditional literary theory of metaphor is largely that it's a matter of words, not thought. And in this view, metaphorical language is traditionally conceived of as part as not as part as of not as a part of ordinary language, but of poetic expression. And thus, we get the sense that it's a gratuitous rhetorical flourish, a colorful way of expressing a thought, and importantly, that we invoke only when we want to, so we have control over it. If that's all that metaphor is, then perhaps then we can understand the resistance to its usage purely as a vehicle for persuasion. And indeed, this is certainly the way in which a number of key figures who have explored and written about intersections between law and literature have understood it, have understood metaphor. One of the most frequently quoted comments on the use of metaphor in law comes from Justice Cardozo, who warns in a case in 1926 called Berkey versus Third Avenue Railroad, metaphors in law are to be narrowly watched, for starting as devices to liberate thought, they often end up by enslaving it. I'll get back to that in a second as well. Now, of course, Cardozo was no stranger to the use of metaphor and other stylistic devices in his judicial opinions. He's well known, right, to be a good literary writer. And that is despite his own apparent recognition of metaphor's possible limitations, at least as expressed there. Another key figure who's investigated the law and literature overlap, Judge Posner, on numerous occasions has voiced criticism of the use of metaphor in law and legal discourse, noting, for example, and I just have a couple of quotes from him, we depreciate decision by metaphor, and responding specifically to Cardozo's use of metaphor, Posner's characterized its use purely as an appeal, purely an appeal to an aesthetic rather than a political or juridical concept. Made as it is without any elaboration, is as irrelevant as it is frivolous in a discussion of, in the case in which this quote is from, criminal procedure, so separate and apart from the issue at hand. Posner elsewhere advocates that literary texts have primarily aesthetic value, and as a consequence should have no bearing on social or judicial policy. So to contextualize his statements a little bit further, I think it is worth noting here that Posner largely rejects the notion that literature, and especially literary theory, has much to offer the law. Though he says that his view of the law and literature movement is not all negative, his focus typically is on what he views to be its limitations. So for him, theories of interpretation derived from literary studies generally have nothing to offer us. Instead, he thinks they can be dangerous because they tend to encourage uncertainty. So we could stop here, as many people have, and debate these points only, and there's a broad literature doing just that. But I want to get us beyond that a little bit and argue that, especially with respect to metaphor, these observations of both Cardozo and Posner obscure a more central critical point, which is simply stated as metaphor is not just a rhetorical flourish. And before I expound on that, let me say that I think part of the attraction of metaphor, even as a literary device, is to challenge the way that we actually think about things. So another point to note before I get into the ways in which metaphor theory has changed is to note that even as a literary device, it's about the comparison between often two subjects in very different contexts. The result being, and I alluded to this earlier, that the second term often provides a new way of conceiving the first. The result is the notion that the qualities of the second term are transferred onto the first. And here the etymology of the word metaphor is actually relevant. Originally from the Greek, it means to transfer, meta implying a change, and pherein meaning to bear or to carry. So again, the result here is the notion that the qualities of the second term get transferred onto the first. So to go with the Shakespeare example, the characteristics of a play performed on stage are transferred onto the idea of the world. Perhaps for rhetorical flourish, but also perhaps because we gain something about our knowledge of the world, a rather difficult concept to encapsulate in a sentence, let alone a single word, by comparing it to something arguably more tangible, our experience with theatrical performances. And now what I've just said becomes important when I get to the cognitive approaches to this. But a final point I think is worth mentioning, that is, it should go without saying that the two terms in the metaphorical comparison generally are not equal. So it's not a one-to-one comparison, though linguistically structured as such. The power of the metaphor, as it's understood, and again, even as purely a rhetorical device, lies in the fact that the transfer of qualities between the two components is not a one-way street. Rather, there's a primary term, the source of the metaphor, so for here, in my example, the stage, and the target of the metaphor, the world, and it's the use of one to understand the other, but typically not in the reverse. So the target's not also providing information about the source. Okay, so now the I think more interesting stuff. Metaphor as a cognitive mechanism. So what is this deeper understanding that I've alluded to? Why do metaphors work? To answer these questions, I think, and to get at what really is going on when we invoke metaphor requires some knowledge, I think, of where metaphor theory finds us today, finds itself today, and us. Another way of thinking about metaphor, and I think the better approach, stems from George Lakoff and Mark Johnson's work, Voluminous, in a work in 1980 that really sort of set off a lot of this thinking called Metaphors We Live By, another book called Philosophy in the Flesh. I highly recommend them if you're interested in this. There, Lakoff and Johnson posit that metaphor is much more than merely a matter of words. Instead, it's integral to our thought processes and thus cannot be chalked up purely to literary or rhetorical technique. Rather, metaphor is an integral part of the way we actually understand concepts that otherwise might evade us. So in this view, our ordinary conceptual system, in terms of which we both think and act, is fundamentally metaphorical in nature. And I'm going to try to explain that a little bit. Another, I think, critical point here is that it you start to see it as not just a choice, not just a choice that we make in writing or in speaking, you know, in a sort of literary way, but it's present in the way that we actually think, and so therefore we can't escape it. So they offer, Lakoff and Johnson, an experiential approach to metaphor, meaning that it stems from and works because of how we experience the world in a very physical sense, as bodies interacting in and with the world. It's called often an embodied theory of metaphor for that reason. And metaphors in operation often are so deeply ingrained that they're difficult to bring to the surface. So one of the things I'm going to walk you through a couple of their primary examples is that I struggle with this often because sometimes the metaphors really are so deeply ingrained that they're hard to see as metaphors. You start thinking, no, that's actually true, X is Y, when their argument is that it's premised on metaphorical thinking. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples. One of my favorite is understanding is seeing. Now, the way that they bring these metaphors to the surface is to look for expressions in the language, already existing in the language, and to look at how we think about what it means to understand something. So I'll give you a few. I don't see your point. I'm not seeing things clearly. Your statement is very illuminating. Can you shed light on this issue? I was in the dark for a long time. She finally opened her eyes to what was going on around her. It was easy to see what was behind his actions. He saw through her lies. I had blinders on. I was in a real fog, et cetera, et cetera. So again, what's going on here? Lakoff and Johnson would say that what it means to understand something is a difficult concept for us to grasp cognitively. However, sight is a very sensory function that we have every, it is a sensory function, that we have everyday tangible embodied experience with. And so at a deep cognitive level, we're processing ideas as perceptions, as things that can be seen. And thus the cognitive metaphor understanding is seeing. A couple other briefly, argument is war. So looking again for expressions in the language, your claims are indefensible. He attacked the weak points in my argument. Her criticisms were right on target. I demolished his argument. I won that debate. I could go on. Time is money is also commonly quoted from them. And there, the notion is that time is a resource, is an economic resource like money. You're wasting my time. This device will save you hours. We talk of spending time, investing time, using time profitably, those kinds of things. So these two metaphors in Lakoff and Johnson's view, these three, suggest that we actually experience argument as battle and time as a valuable commodity or limited resource. And what they say is that if you looked at expressions in a different culture that didn't experience argument as battle, it's hard to even imagine a culture in which that would be true. But they posit sort of an example of a culture where argument is viewed as a dance, where participants are performers and the goal is to perform in a balanced and aesthetically pleasing way. You might see, arguably you would see, expressions that are very different from the way that we talk, especially as lawyers, about what argument is. In the understanding of seeing metaphor, I think one of the understanding of seeing metaphor and the time is money metaphor, one last point just about their theory is maybe worth noting, which is that certain part of what makes the metaphor work are that the concepts don't map entirely onto one another. So they're still offering only a partial understanding. So in other words, there are limits to which the metaphor goes. And this is where you get the sense that understanding isn't actually seeing, but that there's something more metaphorical going on. Because we don't, for example, talk about understanding in terms of distance. So that's something that, you know, we would talk about as a sensory function. You know, distance can matter in terms of the way that we actually see things. But we don't get expressions like, I can't see that idea, it's too far away. So distance becomes a place where things don't map. Okay, so really briefly, what does this have to do with the law? So my colleagues are going to discuss this in more detail. For starters, though, I wanted to say that, throw out a couple of basic examples and to say first that if Lakoff and Johnson are right, that we can't control our use of metaphor purely as a turn of phrase, then in the law or any other realm, then we have to try to understand it or should try to understand it. It's possible that when Cardozo or any other jurist invokes a metaphor, it's also a decision-making tool. So rather than try to avoid it, it seems that the best approach and the way to avoid it enslaving us, in Cardozo's terms, is to bring it to the surface, to make our tacit assumptions more explicit. So stated otherwise, if a metaphor is central to human rationality in the way that the cognitive theorists have talked about it, then it's as inevitable in legal analysis and discourse as it is anywhere else. And the law, as you may already recognize, and as Linda Berger has written about the corporation, our understanding of the corporation as a person and actually as exhibiting characteristics, human characteristics. You have notions of that our whole rationale for freedom of expression is based on a marketplace of ideas, where we see another metaphor there in operation. And numerous people, for example, have written about cyberspace as a physical location, and then property law as actually applying there. And that is arguably metaphorical. One last sort of piece of this for me comes from a theorist called named Stephen Winter, who's done a lot of work. He's a common law professor that you may be familiar with his work. He's done a lot of work applying cognitive theory, Lakoff and Johnson's in particular, to the law. At the most basic level, he asks us to understand legal rules to be operating in the same way as cognitive metaphors, where there is perhaps a core of settled meaning, the easy cases at the center, and then a periphery around that wherein the hard cases are decided. The point is to establish a better and deeper understanding of how and where we draw the lines that become mechanisms for decision making. And he, to do this, proffers the same experiential approach that Lakoff and Johnson do. Let's see. Okay, last point. A related and what I think is possibly the most interesting point about this, and some of this comes from Winter's work, is that the cognitive theory of metaphor exposes, I think, some of the assumptions at the very basis of one of the law's most entrenched debates over theories of textual interpretation. And so now, in contrast to you have the very prominent and powerful new textualist approach adopted and in constant use by Justice Scalia, among others. They have long adhered to the notion that meaning resides in words themselves, and they constantly reject any attempt really to ascertain meaning, for example, of a particular statutory provision by looking to legislative history or evidence outside the text itself. So readers are supposed to be able to unpack words to reveal this core of objective meaning that allegedly resides in the text. What I think is really interesting is that this whole philosophy really depends on the operation of a very complex cognitive metaphor, and one of the first that was really mined in this field, which is called as a package the conduit metaphor. It consists of several systematic sets of mappings from a source, and that is our experience with physical objects, to a target, which is our mental operations. So the series of systematic mappings are often laid out as ideas are actual objects, words are containers for meaning, communication involves sending an object to a person who can receive it in a physical way, grasp it, and unpack it, its meaning. So I think, of course, don't suggest that just revealing the series of metaphorical mappings is necessarily going to change entrenched theories of meaning construction, but I do think that a better understanding of why we draw lines in certain places stands to make the choices we have more apparent and our decisions more transparent. And thus, the point really is precisely the opposite of the common perception from where I began, that metaphors obscure, constrain, and enslave. The contrary, I would argue that they liberate.
I didn't plan it this way, but if I could have had somebody, you want somebody to go in front of you to deal with Lakoff and Johnson and those sorts of things, I'd have said, wonderful. So this is a nice predicate for what I'm going to focus on. One of the primary problems I think that is embedded in the law is a belief that linguistic communication is essentially, although not entirely, a process of just decoding. Somebody speaks, They put words in a certain order. Syntax tells you what subject, what's the recipient, the direct object of action and the like. And that all we got to do is basically have this mental dictionary there. When people speak a phrase, we just pull it out, and in our minds comes up everything that has been referred to by the words. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. Or fortunately, that's not the way it works, because we would have a very hard time communicating quickly and accurately. Primary insight that I think I've gotten from reading in cognitive science, and being a philosophy major, I spent years, I think, wasting my time trying to find answers like this in philosophy, because I believe that the traditional fields of epistemology, ontology, and the like in philosophy are now being subsumed under cognitive science. But what we learn from cognitive science is the way we understand words and the way we expect others to understand words is by taking into account everything we know, not just what may be in a dictionary. And what we do is we take the information in that we hear or read, and we take everything else that we know that we can recognize is relevant, and we understand and legitimately may understand. In fact, we can't avoid it if we're going to be rational and logical. Everything that we can infer from that combination of information. Let me give you an example. Suppose you have a guest over. It's getting to be about 11 o'clock, and conversation is interesting, and so you say, hey, I think I'll make some coffee. Would you like some? Suppose the party answers, it would keep me awake. Well, does that mean they want it or don't want it? Well, on the one hand, suppose you know that the person needs to, when they leave, stay up all night to study for an exam in the morning. You would understand it will keep me awake to mean yes. Look at the difference. It will keep me awake is something, that's something I want. You take the information and you understand yes. If the person, on the other hand, got to get a good night's sleep because they got to talk to get in the morning and they're always better when they're well rested, you would understand them to mean no. So what is meant and what is said or written is often radically different. My favorite story, pulled out of a work by Sperber and Wilson called Relevance, to work on cognitive psychology and our understanding of language. And they give this example. 1935. A couple of fellows are talking about what's going on in the Soviet Union. And one's a liberal optimist, and, oh, he believes that everything that the Soviet government's putting out is absolutely correct. You know, it is a worker's paradise. And the other fellow's the old conservative, skeptical type, and he says, I don't believe that's happening. Well, they go back and forth for a while, and then the brilliant idea occurs to them that if somebody went and looked, maybe they could report. So the optimist says, well, let me go look. I'm the one that's asserting the truth of the matter, so burden's on me. Now he says, I'm going to go, but I know very well that they could be lying. It could all be a put on. And if that's the case and it's truly a repressive society, they won't let me write the truth. I know that. So what I'll do is I'll write whatever they want me to, but I'll write it in purple ink. Friend says, sounds like a good plan to me. Okay, so it goes off, and a year later, the letter comes back, and it's just glowing, and it says, you know what, I couldn't have believed it, really. It's better than they said. The workers all live in castles. They have Dom Perignon every evening with their caviar, and just goes on and on and on. He said, but the most amazing thing about the Soviet Union, it's the consumer goods that are available. You just can't imagine. Everything you want is here, with one exception. You can't find purple ink. Okay, now that's what I'd like to say to the textualist. You can't find purple ink is obvious. The meaning is obvious, indubitable of that string of words. Yet in that setting, taking in all of the other information you have, what it means is what they say about the Soviet Union is a bunch of lies. And if you look at the semantic difference between what is meant and what is said, there is almost no conceptual overlay at all. Now, where does this come back to metaphor and the like? Well, one of the views of metaphor is that metaphorical words, as mentioned, when you use a word as a metaphor, you tend to drop some of its previous meaning. You may retain just a piece of it, and you may add more in. My favorite example is a valuable opportunity, a golden opportunity. It's interesting. People, if you use that phrase, they don't think of an opportunity that's really colored, embodied, and golden. They understand you to mean a valuable opportunity. Why? Well, they know that opportunities are not the things that have length, width, depth, color, weight, and all of that. But gold is something that has all of those things and is valuable. And so what they do is they drop the conceptual components that are not proper and add, keep the one that is. And this is a process that occurs so automatically that we have no idea it's happening. The vast majority of our thought occurs completely out of consciousness, behind consciousness. If I ask you a question and you respond, and then I ask you, how did you come up with those particular words? You cannot tell me. But the fact is your mind is loaded with massive amounts of information, and you can bring all of that to bear, and you have to bring all of that to bear. And this isn't just a matter of convenience. It's also an epistemological truth. As Alvin Goldman, who is one of the better epistemologists in my view today, says, and he's very heavily into cognitive science, he understands it extremely well, any statement, for us to say that any statement is true, we must be able to show that it is consistent with everything else in the universe we know to be true, because you cannot have something that is both true and not true at the same time. We can't comprehend what that means. Now, there are things that we don't know whether they're true or not. Now, that's a different matter, indefinite. So when you say words mean such and such, what we have to do is take into account not only what their dictionary definitions may be, but we also have to take into account what the purpose of those words is. What is somebody trying to communicate? And take personal characteristics if it's an individual and the like. And we draw inferences. And epistemologically, we can't refuse to draw those inferences. Otherwise, we are engaging in contradictory thinking. We are saying certain things are true and not true at the same time. So give my example. It would keep me awake. If you say, well, all that means is it would keep me awake, and yet knowing that the person wants to stay awake, you say, well, you can't draw any inference that the person wants coffee. I think most of us would say that's absurd. What you're saying is the person doesn't want coffee, but you know the person does. And so you can't really back out of this. Now, of course, what this means is, in my view, textualism is dead. It has no intellectual force at all, because it requires us to violate the most fundamental principles of epistemology. Not only that, it violates the most fundamental principles of what we know about linguistic meaning and understanding today. And it means that legal reasoning is indeed the somewhat more difficult process, I think, that we all have instinctively understood it to be. And that is the process of taking a legal rule, looking at what it was designed to do, considering other things the law is attempting to accomplish simultaneously. And if we find no conflicts, we pretty much will apply the rule as it appears. But when we find serious conflicts, what we try to do is take all of that information into account in a way that provides us the most coherent and rational understanding. And I will get to metaphor in just a second. What that means is, with respect to law, I spent 30 years working on this topic, many of them in practice. And it finally, after having done a lot of work in the background work in the cognitive science, linguistics, it finally hit me what was going on. And I've recently written an article, come out. What I've concluded is the fundamental problems we face in law is that all legal rule systems are inherently incomplete. No way anybody can draft something that covers every conceivable circumstance, every conceivable conflict of purposes up front. However, we can address those things as they arise from time to time after the fact, just like we do in the military, American military system of command. When you are given an order, you're expected to think, not blindly obey. You will be really, really raked over the coals if you blindly obey when it's obvious you should not. What you are expected to do is to take the fundamental assumptions underlying the order, what the order is designed to accomplish, and as you begin to carry out your mission, if you discover that those underlying assumptions are wrong, knowing what your objective is, you're expected to redraw the plan, if you will, to use that training that you've been given to revise the order to achieve the objective, because unlike the totalitarian societies where they just want strict obedience, in this system, they want the result. And it's interesting, there's a book called Culture and Carnage by Victor Hansen, in which he points out that one of the advantages Western societies have had against Eastern totalitarian states is the group discussion and thought. And so that when Alexander went up against the Persians, one of the problems Persians had was that their generals were not allowed to think. If you were to think on your own and win a battle, you were still likely to be executed for having failed to do what the god king had told you to do. Achieving the victory was not enough. You had to do what you were told. So they did what they were told. And of course, as they say, battle plan is perfect until the minute the battle begins. And then you have to engage in all sorts of adaptations to achieve your objective. And so when you're dealing with folks who will not take all of the information into account to achieve objectives, you fail. So that's one of my problems with textualism. I just think it's basically very wooden-headed and overlooks realities of the way we understand. Okay, for the metaphor. If you look at words as they come out of ordinary usage and are incorporated into law, I think you'll find that almost all words are implicitly metaphor. All words in the law are implicitly metaphors when viewed in terms of ordinary language. In other words, there is not a basket out there full of all the meanings that we currently need for every law. You can't find one. You can't find those meanings already pre-cut. What you find are things that are pretty close. So what you do is you go to your basket of words and you pull one in, and in light of what you can think, you may even do a little tinkering with it up front. You may even give it some special definition. But that's not going to be the end of the process, because there are going to be an unlimited number of things that you never anticipated. And what you may need to pull in to the category the word denotes, what you may need to pull out of the word to make the category fit with the purposes of the law, other purposes of the law, so that you have a coherent theme in the law, is quite a complex process. In my article, I identified 13 ways. Well, I identified 16 ways that laws can appear incomplete in terms of the rules that they need. I also identified 13 ways that words coming out of ordinary speech will not necessarily fit the law. And a few examples are, which one, I got some favorites here, unreasonable restraint of trade that came out. Somebody might say, well, that's ambiguous. No, that's not the problem. Ambiguity is only two of the problems. There are two different kinds of ambiguity with words. There's also syntactical ambiguity. There's ambiguity of purpose. So there are a lot of kinds of ambiguity. Unreasonable restraint of trade. Congress didn't have the slightest idea of what it meant. Law came out in 1890. The first real solid treatment of microeconomics came out the same year at Cambridge when Alfred Marshall produced his Principles of Economics. It didn't have the tools of economic analysis. It's taken us over 100 years to come up with the tools of economic analysis that permit us to really understand, in light of our goals, what an unreasonable restraint of trade is. Could look it up in the dictionary. My other favorite is out of the securities laws. One of the things you're permitted to do is avoid registering securities if you have an offering that is not non-public, or what we call a private offering. Okay, well, how should that be defined? Well, Wall Street has a very clear definition of private offering, and that is something that's made to a group of people other than through the general underwriting process. Okay, well, Ralston Purina decided to sell some of its stock to key employees. Not to the country in general, not to anybody who wanted to come in off the street and buy it, but to their key employees. Key employees included folks like the feed store manager in Omaha, Nebraska. SEC didn't like this and came in, and I think the Supreme Court adopted the perfect meaning. It said a public offering is one that is made to people who don't need the protections of the act. A private offering is one that is made to those very limited folks who don't need the protection of the act. Now, when you think about it for a second, that had to be a new meaning. It's implicit, in my view, unassailable. But it had to be a new meaning. It could not have conceivably existed before the 1933 Securities Act, because the definition itself references the act. So therefore, we had a new word. Now, it's a public offering. Why do I say it's metaphorical? Is because it is very similar. Even under the Supreme Court's view, almost everything, if not everything, that would have been a public offering remains a public offering. But some things that the securities industry would not have called public offerings gets put in. The concept is radically revised. The items covered, minor. So my conclusion is that if you take a look at most of the key words in either statutory or common law settings, makes no difference which one, you will find that they are implicit metaphors of pre-existing concepts. And if you start looking in dictionaries, which oddly enough, all of the linguists seem to agree are just absolutely rotten. And so that kind of makes me wonder what in the world our Supreme Court justices are doing looking to dictionaries when the experts tell you they're no good. They'll give you the basic spelling of a word and a, you know, close idea of what it is, but they are not useful. And especially are they not useful if what we are dealing with is the creation of new meanings. It does no good to look in the past for something that has never existed, but is implicitly created in the context of the purposes of the law and everything else that we're trying to accomplish simultaneously.
So I guess my role here is to be the applier. I'm grateful that I don't have to talk that much about theory, and instead I'm going to try to talk about how metaphor and narrative work in a particular slice of the law. And the slice of the law that I've chosen is child custody disputes, not because I'm an expert at child custody, which I'm not, and so those of you who are, just refrain from asking me substantive questions, but because child custody disputes, I think, really illustrate really very nicely how metaphor and narrative work, often unconsciously, within the law. In fact, some people believe that in child custody disputes, metaphor and narrative work as ideological baggage carriers that bring messages from one place to the other below the level of conscious discourse. That kind of a phrase makes it sound as if I'm against metaphor and narrative. I like the phrase, ideological baggage carriers. But I am very much in favor of metaphor and narrative, but you know, it doesn't really matter whether I am or not, because regardless, I'm going to have to use them. We all have to use them every day, and especially in the law, we're going to have to use them. So even if I wasn't in favor of them, I would be using them. But like Christy was saying earlier, the frameworks provided by metaphor and narrative, the theorists believe, do in fact constrain and limit us, but they also structure and enable imagination. And that at least is what we will contend for hopefully when I get to the end of my presentation. So there is a case out there, a child custody case that I am going to talk about. I'm going to try to get there pretty quickly, but I do have a little bit of groundwork I have to lay first. Some of it is just a real quick recapitulation of the theory. First of all, as I keep wanting to call them both Christy, because we have Christy and Gordon. But as Gordon mentioned, one of the things the cognitive scientists say that they have found is that much of what we know is tacit knowledge. It's knowledge that takes place beneath the surface. I don't know about you, but I've always been a little suspicious of scientists. Nonetheless, I've decided that I'm going to take that. That makes sense to me. That resonates with me, and so I believe that that's true. So the first thing that from the cognitive science that I would like you to sort of accept, at least for the purposes of this discussion, is that much of what we know, much of what we understand is tacit knowledge. That becomes very persuasive, because if it's not even on the surface, you don't even talk about it. The second thing from cognitive theory that that Christy talked about is the fact that thought processes themselves are metaphoric. Now, we obviously talk about thought processes as if they are metaphoric, but the theorists say that they in fact function metaphorically, that you can't think about abstract concepts without thinking, without seeing them as a concrete phenomenon. And I think that's a very powerful insight, and that also resonates to me. I don't know if resonates with me. I don't know whether the science is true or not, but it certainly makes sense to me. The third thing that I'm going to mention, because it comes up in the context of the case, is that one of the conceptual structures that the theorists say comes out of our interactions with the environment is something called an idealized cognitive model. An idealized cognitive model is just a very complicated set of metaphors that is joined with stories and folk theories and other things, and explains an entire area of cultural understanding. The one I'm going to talk about is the idealized cognitive model of mother. You'll see when we get there that this does in fact seem like it is an idealized cognitive model. This is one of the ways that metaphor can carry ideological baggage, because it is bringing together all of these different things at the same time. And all of those things are not articulated when you use or you conjure up the idealized cognitive model of mother. The fourth thing that I'd like to mention very briefly is that, unlike the foundationalist view of the law, the view of the metaphor theorists is that it doesn't matter whether or not a metaphor is true or false. Correspondingly, I think it probably doesn't matter whether a narrative is true or false. I think somebody asked that question this morning. What matters for the theorist is how the metaphor works. What are its inferences? What are its applications? How does it affect that particular area of the law? I think that probably is also true of narrative, but I don't know that much about narrative theory. Fifth, narrative and metaphor are very much interrelated. Stephen Winter, who Christy mentioned, says that narrative cannot be understood without this cognitive background that consists of metaphors. On the other hand, there are a number of theorists in narrative who believe that metaphors really are not as persuasive as they might otherwise be unless they are embedded within a particular narrative. So metaphor and narrative work together. When they are both acting together, they make for especially persuasive things. And the final thing, which I don't think either one of my colleagues talked about, was that categories, which are so important in the law, are not really bounded the way that we think they are. They're not a box in which everything within that category is exactly the same. And instead, the theorists say that they are structured as radial categories. There's a prototype in the middle. For example, the example I like is that the prototype for bachelor is George Clooney. That's not the one they use. That's the one I use. The prototype for bachelor is George Clooney. The Pope is probably not within the center of the radial category of bachelor, but that is a good illustration of how categories are actually radial as opposed to being definitional the way that we think of them. In order to talk about my child custody case, I have to do one more thing, and that is I need to talk about some of the accepted stories and images in family law. So bear with me while I go through these fairly quickly, too. The first one is the accepted story of family law, and I would venture a guess that this is the accepted story of most areas of the law, is one of progress. Of course, as the law changes, we are progressing, right? We must be progressing. And the accepted story of family law is that we are progressing toward equality and neutrality, so that the spot that we're in now is the best place for us to be. Within family law, there are some very influential master stories, is what one person, Michael Goldberg, calls them. These master stories are narratives that are so embedded in our history and culture that we really cannot avoid them. We really cannot escape them. First and foremost, within family law, the master story that's embedded is the biblically derived unity between husband and wife. This is such a powerful master story that it supports the claim that the marital family, not a natural family, but that the marital family is the natural and the morally superior family form, which leads me to the image that of the ideal family that takes place in much of family law, which is exactly that image, the image of the marital family. In their book, Tony Amsterdam and Jerome Bruner talk about Justice Scalia's decision in the Michael H. case, where they say that Justice Scalia's concept of the natural family as the marital family is the engine by which they make the natural father the outsider, and only the marital family becomes the ideal family that is protected by the law. This, in fact, as most of us know, this ideal family, the marital family, is not, in fact, where most children in the United States grow up today. There are many iterations of family in the United States today, and in fact, the marital family with the husband as the wage earner and the wife as caregiver was not even the model in the United States until the beginning of the 20th century. Before that, or the beginning of the 19th century, I believe. But before that, the family was a household which included both parents staying home, both parents taking care of the children to the extent the children were taken care of at all. The children were working as well as the parents, and it wasn't until much later that world work and family work were bifurcated. But that image of there being a wage earner, a marital family, including a wage earner and a caregiver, and those being two different people, and usually the wage earner is the male, also affects family law. Next, the next image I'm going to talk about is the image of the good mother. Most people trace the image of the good mother to the Madonna, virtuous, nurturing, and asexual. Now, that has been changed to some extent so that the image of the good mother in family law is virtuous, nurturing, and attached to a male sexual partner who is her husband. Professor Winter calls this the idealized cognitive model of motherhood. Natural childbirth by a woman who is married to the biological father and who is also the primary nurturer and full-time caretaker. If you fit that model, then you're a good mother. If you do not fit that model in any way, then you are not a good mother. There are other historical and cultural precedents that affect our view of the good mother. I talk in another setting about the story of King Solomon and how that sets up the cultural model of a good mother as the person who gives up everything for her child, or is willing to give up everything for her child. The institution of motherhood depicts mothers as just naturally more capable of being the primary caregiver. It also demands more from mothers than from fathers. If a mother only cares for her children financially, she's a bad mother. If a father only cares for his children financially after divorce, he is a good father. Working mothers, of course, are good mothers only if they work because they have to. The final sort of contextual, I don't mean that as a sentence, that we can change this. Imagination is important. The final thing that I want to do to set up the case is to talk about just what's happening with child custody standards. For a very long time, fathers just had the right to custody of their children. It was both a legal right, and they were the only ones with the economic means to do so. Then there was a brief period where the maternal or tender years preference sort of took the place of the father's right. At that time, there actually was a stated best interest of the child standard, but many courts had used the maternal or tender years preference. The women's movement, the men's movement, the equal rights movement did away with the maternal preference, and we are now with what I believe is really a very poorly named standard, the best interest of the child standard. Because that standard is so vague, and because trial court judges have so much discretion in implementing that standard, I think it's not surprising that they turn to their cognitive unconscious to decide what will be the ideal image and what will be in the best interest of the children. So let us turn to the case that I've given you. And I'm going to talk about, even though this is an appellate decision, I'm going to talk about the trial court story within that appellate decision. I'm assuming everybody has a handout. This is the Roe v. Franklin case. So to briefly recap what happened in that case, and this is all on that first page, Kimberly and Donald got married 7 months later, and the court opinion actually is careful about giving you the dates. My assumption is they wanted to make sure that you could figure out it was 7 months later. I don't know, but otherwise I couldn't figure out why they gave you those dates. 7 months later, their son is born. When the son is 3 and a half, Kimberly leaves with the child. The son stays with his mother. Parties agree on temporary custody. 6 months later, Kimberly moves from Ohio to Kentucky. As best I can determine from the case, this is about 2 hours away, where she was in Ohio to where she went in Kentucky. At first, the move is supposed to be only for the summer. At the end of the summer, Kimberly asks for court permission to relocate in Kentucky with her son. She has a new boyfriend. She's pregnant. She's going to law school 18 months after the separation, and this is about a year after she's moved to Kentucky. The trial court judge orders a change in custody to Donald. Now, why does the trial court judge do that? In the opinion, if you will look at the second page, the trial court goes through first the sort of a paragraph above where I'm showing you on the second place, goes through a paragraph where they say, well, both of these parents are actually pretty good parents, and so now I'm going to have to justify how come I changed custody of the child, which is a very unusual thing to happen if you know anything about child custody law, and am giving it to the father. After custody has been in place for a particular period of time, for a length of time, trial court judges are reluctant to change custody awards. So the first thing that I think that the trial court judge draws on, and I'm saying, or my claim is, that this is part of the cognitive unconscious of this particular trial court judge, is the metaphor of roots and the categorization of the marital residence as home. So by making those two connections, I think the trial court judge is justifying what he's done. The trial court stated that for the first 3 years of the child's life, the child lived in the marital residence, which is presently occupied by the father. He's familiar with that. He has his roots in Cincinnati. His home would be one of stability. He has family here. He has friends here. He has friends of both parents who care for him here. The only adjustment he has to make is that mom is not here. That's the only adjustment he has to make. So the marital residence where the child has not lived for 18 months is characterized as his home in that particular paragraph. Then the trial court judge says the mother and child did not have substantial roots in the Kentucky community. The appellate court disagrees with that and says the record doesn't support them. But the next step that the trial court takes, and again, I'm saying this is sort of an unconscious step, is to categorize the new family as not a home. It's not a marital family, and it is not a home. Trial court thoroughly examined the child's adjustment to the new home. Described the home as consisting of a mother who is attending law school, working part-time, mothering an approximate six-month-old child, that's her new child, dating a man, the father of a new child, who apparently spends a lot of time in her house, but lives somewhere else, and she is substantially financially dependent on this home. All of this, which is not the marital residence, has required a lot of adjustment on the part of the child. Therefore, this cannot be the home of the child. Next, the court goes on to say the mother fails to match the idealized cognitive model in virtue. Now, this is me saying this. The court didn't actually come out and say the mother didn't match the model in virtue, but it does say the mother made decisions that caused the court to question her stability. Included in these questionable things that she did were the many moves she made, the move to Kentucky, and the sudden and complete relationship with her new male companion and the resulting pregnancy. So obviously, if the idealized cognitive model is a virtuous mother, one who stays with her husband or at least gets married before she starts a new relationship, this mom does not fit that model. Next, the trial court judge says the mother fails to match the model in nurture. Here, it really gets down to the point in that paragraph where the court doesn't really recognize that the reason that the mother moved and the reason that the mother went to law school was to provide financially for her child, or at least that's something that the mother's advocate certainly could have argued. Instead, the trial court says it finds little, if any, value in her setting up residence in Kentucky. So in this way, she falls short because she's not about nurture. She's about doing something else. And that becomes really clear in the next paragraph, where the court concludes that she is not a self-sacrificing mother, and in my mind, that the court is unconsciously drawing on the model of King Solomon. In examining the party's commitment, the trial court concluded that personal accomplishments and career goals are obviously worthwhile. Ms. Rowe has accomplished a lot in academics. That's commendable, but the child has paid a price. She returned to full-time job. Full-time law school curriculum returned to her job. Her time to nurture has been limited tremendously. The court questions her priorities. She basically has been following her personal agenda and is not as committed to the child's best interests as she should be. And, by the way, not as committed as the trial court believes that it is to the child's best interests. Finally, one more. The new relationship, remember the model family is the marital family. The mother's new relationship doesn't match that either. Even though the male companion is a good, dedicated individual, he's working a lot, he's settling down from the breakup of his previous marriage, taking care of two children, lots of stress. The court expressed concern that he became involved with the mother so shortly after separation from his wife. He must not really be very stable if he did that. He needs to settle down and regroup, and then they're concerned at the end of the second paragraph just about all the what-ifs that are present in this situation. Some of these things, I don't mean to imply that none of these things should concern the trial court. It's just that it seems that these things that are concerning the trial court do derive not from the stated reasons and the stated facts so much as they derive from these images and models and stories that are in the background. The final thing that I wanted to point out in this case is what I've been calling the Solomon problem. In the story of King Solomon, which I'm sure most of you have either heard or read or vaguely recall, that King Solomon was approached by two women who, according to the gospel, were harlots and lived alone together. They both had babies. One of the babies had died during the night. Both of the women in front of King Solomon said, "My baby is the live baby. You decide." And Judge Solomon, the wise judge, says, "I tell you what, I'm going to split the baby in half." Judge Solomon probably would not have actually, King Solomon probably would not actually have split the baby in half. This was a trick, essentially, to try to get the, quote, true mother to reveal herself. And the reason that we know that the true mother revealed herself is that she was willing to give up her own child in order to save, supposedly, the child's life. As a number of feminist scholars have pointed out, you don't really know that the person who spoke up is the true mother at all, even when you read the story. In fact, the person who spoke up might just be the one who's a little bit more quick on her feet, perhaps the better liar, perhaps the one that understood that King Solomon was tricking them both in order to reach an adjudication. But the King Solomon model, I believe, stands as a model for trial court judges everywhere who will look at the facts and decide that they are the best person to decide on those facts. And in the best interest of the child adjudication, they are given all the discretion in the world to do so. That raises the problem that the appellate court discusses in that last paragraph. Yes, occasionally the trial court judge will be found to have abused his discretion. Yes, occasionally the appellate court will reverse and remand, but usually that's 2 years later. 2 years later, the trial court is not going to remove the child from the mistaken custody decision in the first place. Meanwhile, in the trial court where these mistaken custody decisions are made, the other litigants are going forward within the context of prior decisions and within the context of trial court judges who impose certain standards on the best interests of the child standard. And in fact, you cannot overturn these decisions other than in name only, as this court well recognizes in the final paragraph of the case. Now, is there anything wrong with this? You know, I'm a fan of metaphor and narrative, and so the metaphors and the narratives that I believe are uncovered in reading this child custody case as I said earlier, I think metaphor and narrative are unavoidable. I think that they will be used whether we like it or not. So if you find something wrong with it, first of all, what's wrong with it? What I find wrong with it in not only this case, this is not an isolated case. I haven't done an empirical study, but I've read about 150 child custody cases now, and I've read a number of articles by people who've read a lot of child custody cases. There are the best interests of the child standard allows judges to import their cognitive unconscious. Some people say it's their stereotypes and their biases. I'm calling it the little more neutral cognitive unconscious concept. But it allows the judges to do that, and in many cases, they do in fact impose stereotypes. What's wrong with that, because we all do that, right? It's a shortcut. It makes things easier. But what's wrong with that, it really are two things. One is the stereotypes are often outmoded. They no longer, if they ever did, reflect what's going on in society. They no longer reflect what's going on in society, especially in the times that we now live in, when families are constituted in many, many, many different ways beyond the marital family. It seems to me that this kind of a standard and these kinds of decisions based on these underlying narratives and metaphors disturb a number of families. So that's one of the things that I think is wrong with it. The second thing that I think is wrong with it is that it, because it's below the surface, it's not discussed. And the litigants and their lawyers, to the extent that they have lawyers, which is another problem, are not able to counter those hidden narratives and metaphors, or those unconscious narratives and metaphors. What can be done about it? I think the only thing that can be done about it, and hopefully others of you will have better ideas than I do, is to use your imagination. I'm sort of hoping that Jim White would still be here so that I could say, use your imagination, which is one of the things he says in one of his articles, is to use your imagination to take these frames and look at them in different ways. Bell Hooks says you look at things from the margins, and you look at them from unusual angles, odd perspectives, reframe, regroup, rename, reorder, do all of those things, and in that way you may be able to counter some of these underlying metaphors and narratives. Restorying is another idea, sort of along the same lines. I'm thinking of it more of a basic restructuring. And of course, you can always resort to the last resort of scoundrels, change the law. And I think that's the end of what I had to say. Thank you.
Well, thanks to our panelists for your remarks. I personally am proud to be part of a panel that can connect George Clooney to metaphors. That's quite an exciting accomplishment. And at this time, we'd like to open up for your dialogue, questions, and input. And we'd ask that you please use the mic to accommodate the acoustics in this room.
Hello. Yeah, I just want to add a little tidbit to what you said about the changing the law. In Maryland, in the termination of parental rights law, the ultimate standard is the best interest of the child, but the law then goes on to specify dozens of specific factors and considerations that the court is supposed to look at and make findings on and weigh and evaluate, that each one of which seems to be an objective question. Did the department offer adequate services? Did the mother come to the visits? You know, who contributed what money? They're all objective, somewhat objective factors that could be, you know, looked at to decide what's in the best interest of the child, whether you actually believe that's an equation or not. But what I see happens is these prejudices, stereotypes, metaphors, narratives, whatever you want to call them, they sneak in and drive the decisions anyway. And in a case I was just working on, the judge went through all the factors and said, oh, well, this happened here and that happened there and this happened this other place. But you would think that a mother who lost her children would work a little bit harder to try to get them back. And that was the obvious, you know, emotional feeling that drove the judge's decision. And all the other things were just window dressing. So you can change the law, but that doesn't guarantee you're going to get away from the, you know, the metaphors and stories that drive people's decision making.
I was just, are you a child, do you work in child custody?
I'm in the public defender's appellate division, and we represent the parents in termination of parental rights cases, as well as in, we represent people in criminal cases.
I was just going to mention, and some of you may know this, I think it's the ALI has proposed an approximation standard, which means that the child custody decision would be made based on who the approximate percentage of the time each parent was the caretaker, so that it would be if you were the caretaker for 60% of the time, you'd get the child after the divorce 60% of the time. I mean, I think that also, as I was talking to someone earlier, I think that also lends itself to probably some embedded metaphors and stories as you're going along. It also lends itself to some manipulation in the last months of the marriage and it at least is a standard that appears to be more objective on the surface. Am I supposed to stand? Do I have to stand? Okay. All right. Okay, so my question is for Linda. I was looking at that line, the tremendous physical chasm between father and son, which itself is a metaphor. And I was wondering if the gender of the child was a different meta story, or because it seemed to me that it was calling in some kind of biblical, like there is a greater bond between father and son that the mother was somehow interfering with. And I don't know if this is evoking the Abraham Isaac story or something like that. But I was wondering if gender of the child is playing into the cases that you're finding.
Not the ones that I've found, but I have read a study, at least one study, that says that one of the things that makes a difference is to fathers winning custody is the sex of the child, and it's the father, you know, the father and the boy makes a difference. I like the idea that the chasm is another metaphor for Abraham and Isaac. I'm sure there is a story there. I'll add that to the article, Ruth Ann. I'll footnote you.
I was a family lawyer for 10 years before I began teaching full time, and we were talking beforehand. What I think is interesting about this, I think you're right that the judges have these misperceptions and bases and stereotypes, and I agree with you that I think it will be difficult to change those. And what one might learn from this is a very common situation. You see cases like this all the time, and the trial courts reading this kind of decision might simply learn that they can make the same decisions based on stereotypes, yet not use so much hyperbole or things that would lead the court to believe that they were abusing discretion. So you maybe reach the same decisions, like you said, based on the same unfortunate stereotypes, just not be so direct and blatant about those stereotypes in the decisions. And so really, you know, I guess we all agree we have to work on eradicating stereotypes more than we can work on maybe the custody statute.
So actually, if they're less blatant, then we have a bigger problem, don't we?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And most custody decisions, I'd say the overwhelming majority of trial court decisions are not appealed. And so there's a lot of people that are simply unable to even get to this process, and I think your point about it being 2 years after the fact and the court's point is an excellent one.
The other thing that I didn't realize, and as I admitted at the beginning, is that I don't know much about child custody laws, how many people are not represented in child custody cases, and those people obviously are at a huge disadvantage, I would think.
Okay, I can add a little bit to the King Solomon story. I was talking to one of my colleagues who, you know, studies the Jewish commentaries, and the commentators wondered about that story. Why would a mother have a child cut in half? And one of their stories was, well, you know, it's the harlot who says, let's cut the child in half. What does the harlot really want the kid in the first place? Good chance what the harlot wants to do is get the kid and sell it to the other mother. So maybe that's why she says cut the child in half, and then the other mother will say, oh no, you can have the child, and then money changes hands. But they always had those problems with the story, and this was one of their possible solutions. So, you know, where's King Solomon in here? Is this test really a good test? And they also wondered about, you know, who maybe the harlot was just the first person to speak, which is quicker on her feet. They worried about those things as well.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the Monty Python movie, Monty Python, which was The Life of Brian. And and they got this mass crucifixion, and they got all these people up on the cross, and finally word comes through that they're to take Brian down. And so the fellow walks up to the group of them and says, is Brian here? Unfortunately, the real Brian is musing about something else. And one of the fellows picks up on it real fast and says, I'm Brian. And then, of course, they all begin to say, I'm Brian, I'm Brian. So that's the kind of thing that, that worries me, too.
Hi, I'm a great fan of Jerome Bruner and Tony Amsterdam, and you know, read that chapter which talked about Justice Scalia's normative standards, and you know, I just wondered since I just wondered if the legal profession draws or has, even though they're obviously liberals in terms of you know race relations and civil liberties and so forth, whether the profession draws socially conservative but you know really smart men, because I don't think it's I hear that even among liberal leaning lawyers. I mean, when you start talking about family and so forth, their images and the stories they raise strike me as much more leaning towards Scalia, even though, you know, if you're talking to them and, you know, having a drink with them or something, you know, they're very progressive on other subjects. But I've been wondering whether it does draw a more socially conservative person in terms of family norms.
I think that Gordon would say this too. The fact is, this story is so embedded that we all draw on this particular story of the marital family and the unity between husband and wife. It's difficult. We don't believe it's the only story. Many of us in the room, at least, don't believe it's the only story, but the story itself is still, you know, it's in there. It's part of the culture. It's part of the history. Part of the tradition.
Different, you know. I mean, I haven't looked at 150 child custody cases, but you know, I've in the 20 or 30 cases in family law that I've looked at. I mean, there is, you know, symbolism is different. And the literary strategies and the stories are different, but they're still on the conservative side, you know. That's why I asked.
Well, I think there's a built-in conservative bias in the human being. What we grow up with, we tend to think is perfectly natural. And it's interesting, you go into societies where people are abused and downtrodden, and you suggest a different way of life, and they're just aghast, you know, even though it would be far better for them. Their interests would be better off if the society were radically revised. But what they've grown up with, they think is just natural. This is the way it always was. This is the way it always will be. But we tend to have that in all facets of life, and it's quite a trick to get in to yourself to uncover those sorts of things. Why in the world do I think this way? What really justifies it? And a lot of people are not particularly reflective. You know, the world seems to go well enough for them, and so they don't really think and challenge. And I think it's going to be, I think it'll be a continual battle for mankind from now till the end of time. And in the law, I sometimes think we make it worse by giving people all this precedent garbage. Oh, everything that you need to know has been decided in the past. That's as if the judge was intelligent and both lawyers were intelligent. And not only that, they thought of everything that could conceivably be brought to bear in that issue. And that obviously is almost never the case. And so the law builds in, I think, on top of everything, another bias. And it's one of the things that's most infuriating to me is that you look at some of the rulings that come down and you just realize how dead wrong they are. Even in terms of law, if you've practiced in an area for a while, and you just wonder how in the world it could come out that way. My solution is you just got to go back, and you got to go back, and you got to go back until finally they learn a new way of looking at it. It's a long-term process to get courts to see things differently, and requires some failure on the front end, but persistence.
Well, I think this goes along with that. I just wanted to point out that it is useful to see the anthropological roots of something that becomes metaphorical. And just because I happen to live a few blocks from where the whole best interest of the child idea generated and the lawyers in that community, the books came from Yale University, three books on what constitutes the best interest of the child. And those were a group of psychiatrists who were very, very close with a lot of the family lawyers in New Haven, who were the people who developed a lot of the more contemporary ideas on joint custody. And it stemmed from a movement toward a father's liberation and more of an understanding of a father's involvement with the child, and not so much at that point was trying to be some sort of lid on the mother-child bond. But law then has its life of its own, and when it gets moved to different legal locations and when you have a factor analysis, it takes on a different life of its own. So I think that the metaphors are there, but I don't think the genesis is necessarily, you know, where the metaphor then sort of winds up, because it sort of becomes something, it has its own life in a way, and that's a life you see through opinions. But that's why it's useful, I think, at times with students to be able to remind them of the anthropological basis for some of these things, and I think they are connected.
Well, the best interest of the child standard, I think, provides so much discretion and is so vague that it allows for particularly free play. But I don't think any standard would be free of these metaphors and narratives being at play anyway. And I do recognize that the best interest of the child standard was proposed as a way to make things better, just like joint custody was proposed as a way to make things better. And many of these things came from really good places and ended up not being so good, and whatever we propose may end up not being so good either. But it's interesting.
So is this something even that really we ought to rely primarily on the courts to decide? If we decide that best interest of the child is a standard, then shouldn't this be handed off to the psychiatrist, psychologist, sociologist who can do a lot of study and let them tell us what the factors are?
I don't trust them either.
I mean, I'd much rather. I don't know why judges are viewed as being the ones capable of making these decisions, quite honestly.
In this particular case that I handed out, there were three experts and two went with the dad. Is that right? I can't remember. I can't remember my own case. But anyway, it was a split. It was a split. But they did try to bring them in.
I'm thinking actually defining the term on the basis of the best research available so that the court would be held to that, and you would have to introduce evidence relating to that.
I think you answered your own question before when you said that it doesn't matter who is the decision maker. I mean, I think at some level it's just about getting below what's driving that decision. And so a lot of what...
Well, you can do that two ways. You can either get in and eradicate the false assumptions underlying the metaphor, and that quite often can be done. Depends on how strongly tied it is. A religious metaphor like this, very, very hard, I think, to undo. Others maybe not nearly so difficult, but if you can replace an incredibly vague standard basically a meaningless standard if you tell me that it's got that width of discretion, then if you can come up with something more detailed, you have a better chance of dealing with it, at least at the appellate level, because you would look at the evidence introduced and it just doesn't match up. So you can sometimes, I think, control these metaphors that way, and then you have to wait for a few generations for them to die out.
I'm in charge. I get to ask the last question. I keep thinking of a word that Jim White talked about this morning, and that's power and how it plays itself out here in that there are metaphors. Now I'm hearing them everywhere, and you can hardly get through a sentence without a metaphor of some sort. And so they're going to be there. We can be conscious of them or not. They're going to drive decisions and structure the way we think about the law. And I think that we need to think more about how they're formed and embraced and continued by people in power, and how important it is to think through that piece of it, that powerful people are going to, they make the metaphors, and they keep the metaphors in place that keep us thinking in certain ways about the law. And it is not in their interest that the metaphors get changed. And it seems to me terribly important then to teach people, teach aspiring lawyers about the use of metaphor, because it is a way to challenge power as well. So if we can shift the metaphors, change the metaphors, come up with better metaphors and begin to use them, then we can do that challenging of the empire of power that Jim White's talking about.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I think that that's what gets us past Posner really just saying that they're only aesthetic. I mean, I think that the value of looking at the cognitive linguist approach to it is to develop a tool to bring them to the surface, because only at the surface can we dismantle them. And so that's sort of why I don't think it matters so much the particular decision maker in the side discussion we were having before, but in the process of actually bringing them to the surface, seeing what they are and how they operate, and then we can decide, and we can better control them that way. Embedded in that is sort of, yeah, we can, you know, use them to persuade, and that's not necessarily bad, but I think we do have to know what we're talking about. And so many of them, I appreciate your comment that once you start thinking about this, they're everywhere. After I read Metaphors We Live By, I like couldn't sleep for 3 weeks because it was just metaphors all over the place. But I think that's really telling. I mean, they're there. And so why not, you know, attempt to unearth and investigate them, or else, you know, we're sort of rendering ourselves powerless to do anything with them.
In fact, doesn't Posner sort of fall for the market as the perfect clockwork mechanism for allocation in society? You know, this is the perfect thing. I mean, you know, he falls
the
for
market.
One, too.
Yeah, the marketplace maybe for him is sort of the one exception.
Yeah, but he wouldn't recognize that he's governed by them in any way. And yet, if what, and I think it's very clear when you read Lakoff, and he's got another book, Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things, which is simply a category into which certain things fall in a particular Australian language. He says it creates all sorts of excitement because the women's movement sometimes is offended, sometimes they are excited by it, and it's really got nothing to do with that. But he goes into even greater depth there about the one thing I disagree with him on. I do think there are concepts that are clearer than he thinks on a case. He seems to think everything's fuzzy. And I think some are, in fact, fairly tight. But I think it's clear we cannot avoid the metaphors.
All right, I'm going to put in a final plug for George Clooney. No. Somebody mentioned the Amsterdam. I mentioned the Amsterdam and Bruner book, and then you mentioned that you had read the Amsterdam and Bruner book. One of the things I think, if you're going to teach your students to come up with new metaphors and fight the power, that they need to learn to do is to read opinions and everything very critically. And the Amsterdam and Brunner book takes you through a rhetorical analysis of a number of very, very, very objectionable, depending on your point of view, very interesting opinions. And I think it just is good practice to have your students read that and see how they go about looking at these cases and discerning. And you may disagree with them or agree with them, discerning what's going on underneath the surface, because if you don't see it, you have no chance of doing anything about it.
Well, thank you so much for a wonderful panel. At this time, we have a break until 3:45, where we'll pick up with our final panel on archetypes.